for the housekeeping. Just to give you an overview of how we want to do this, we have three presenters today. I'm going to start the presentation off, and Sandy certainly will follow up behind me, and we'll conclude with Stefanos Palaiologis. And we're going to each try to keep our talks about 15 minutes. We really know that this is a topic that people can have a lot of questions about, and I'm going to do my best to, and not, no offense to the speakers, but if they go any closer, if they hit the 20-minute mark, I'm going to have to cut them off, so we can get some really active Q&A at the end of the session. Wanted to start out, I'm starting out with a bit more of an overview of form-based codes. I've been doing extensive research on form-based coding, both through the Form-Based Code Institute over the last couple of years, but more specifically doing research for a book on form-based coding that I'm in the process of co-authoring with Paul Crawford and Karen Carolla, and have really had the opportunity to see a really diverse and advanced application of form-based coding. We do form-based coding within our office, but it's been really great to have the excuse to go actually look at other people's codes, understand what they're doing, and really learn from the advances that each of the different individual firms are making within the application of form-based coding. So I'm actually gonna give a fairly quick overview of what I see as advanced applications of form-based codes, both within codes that we are writing, but in addition to codes that I've seen in various stages of adoption over the course of the last 9 to 12 months. I wanted to start first with a, this is a drawing that I'm sure Steph will actually talk about in a higher level of detail, or a similar drawing. Bowen Palaiologis has established an extremely comprehensive system that plugs into their form-based codes that regulates building types. And so for each one of their codes, you get this, what I would call, I'm not sure what Steph refers to it as, but a continuum of building types. It's really, you're looking at going from a C3 transit zone up to like a T5. I know in other codes or other graphs, I was thinking then this goes up to T6 and you get a tower integrated into this. But really interesting and very complex application of building types within those form-based codes. And this is just a sample, a sheet that regulates the duplex, triplex, and quadruplex within their Whittier-specific plan, the Whittier California. And just to mention briefly, in conversations that I've had with Stefanos and others from his office, really looking at these additional regulations that, we take a step back. Their regulating plans are still regulated through urban standards by each zone. And then each of the zones actually has a table of allowed building types within each zone. And so when you decide which building type you're interested in building, you then go to these building type regulations that give you additional standards such as access, massing, parking location, services that really provide the primary level and primary tool for regulation and entitlement, as opposed to density and FAR that usually provides the level of entitlement through the regulation process. This is a code that we wrote with Crawford and Macari Clark for the city of Grass Valley. We've seen this particular application happening across the country. Jeff Carroll, Mary Madden did a similar code for Peoria, Illinois, where the city has decided to update their entire city zoning code, and for various reasons, whether it be political, and in this instance, not having the budget, the coding team actually went through the analysis and documentation phase of documenting the neighborhood district and corridor framework of the community, and then we worked with the community to actually select the particular areas within the town that the form-based zones would be applied to, and then we had other areas that actually have conventional zones applied. And the system was set up such that as the city tested their form-based zones, they have a framework in place in the future to actually apply those same zones to the rest of the city systematically. And felt that actually was a really good system. So you can see on this regulating plan that what we ended up selecting was the historic downtown core, which is in purple here, the town center. In yellow, we have two individual historic neighborhoods, and then in red, the neighborhood centers. And then as a case study for how their suburban corridor should evolve, we actually selected one suburban arterial on the northern edge of town. Through this, it's a little bit of comic relief. It's kind of an XMU next-gen slide, I think. But I wanted to talk a little bit about, I think there's this myth out there that sort of the East Coast versus West Coast application of the concept in form-based coding. And for those of you who don't know it, this is sort of an infamous hip-hop battle, East Coast versus West Coast. So what I wanted to say here is that what we're finding in our research is that the transect has proven to be a really amazing tool. And I would say 95% of the really advanced practitioners are using the transect as an application for form-based coding. And it's really proven to be a powerful tool. And so there are nuances within every affirmed application, but I just wanted to throw this up and say that contrary to what some people may believe, the transect really is being used by most practitioners, and I think for very good reason. I'm going to jump then to the Miami 20 Zone Code, and I think some of you would probably have been in Liz's presentation this morning on big city codes, but I wanted to, this code is really amazing for a number of reasons, but I just wanted to pull out a couple of them, and Sandy may actually talk a little bit more about this too, I'm not sure, but this is an application of the smart code, and it actually makes some pretty major modifications. The one that's most exciting to me, sort of in relation to my relationship to the transect concept that I just, our concept that I just introduced, is that it actually begins with the application to an existing condition. It actually has a very complex breakdown of subsets of the different transects. And this is actually the land use table. And each of the T3 through the T6 zones has the restricted, limited, and open concepts. And this concept was actually is in the existing 8.0, but it actually is applied in a slightly different way here. So if you can actually get the chance to, all of these codes that I'm showing are actually available. If you just Google and get into the city's website, you can download most of these. And I highly recommend that you go and look at this really advanced way that the Miami 20 Zone Code begins to create these subsets for the different transect zones. And these subsets basically deal with differences in use, differences in building type, and also differences in parking regulations. The other way that the Miami 21 code breaks down the transect zones is within the T6 zone, you actually have T6 dash like 16, 24, and 32, and 48 based on the number of floors that are allowed. And so each one of those different T zones actually has certain standards that relate to that particular T6 zone. And so the other place that becomes applicable is one of the primary goals of the Miami 21 code was to ensure that there's a proper relationship in transition between the more intense or intensifying corridors and the transition to the single-family neighborhoods that are adjacent to these commercial corridors. And so they have specific regulations to set the buildings down as they transition between different T-zones. Montgomery, Alabama is a really interesting case study. A couple of years ago adopted a optional smart code primarily to encourage and allow developers to do T&Ds in the greenfields. And a couple of projects were designed and the city got so excited and so behind the smart code that at the end of last year they hired Bill Nicole to come in and do a master plan for their downtown and to adapt the smart code, that existing smart code with modifications to actually become mandatory within downtown Montgomery, Alabama. These two images are probably two of the most powerful images in relation to form-based coding that I've actually seen, done by Bill Cole. This is the build-out based on not just the zoning, existing zoning regulations, but also an economic study. And you can see the buildings in red, they're sort of few and far between and kind of very disparate, and there's no real framework in place. And this is a similar diagram showing that with the application of the new smart code, what framework and what development would actually be incurred with that new code. So it's a really extremely dramatic difference between the two, and the city was so excited about what came out of the shred, they're actually implementing some of the public improvements already. I know there's a big civic plaza in the center that they started work on almost immediately after the shred. Wanted to mention that form-based codes are also being used as a really powerful preservation tool. This is a code that we did for the city of Benicia, California, and the area with the red dashed outline here, Benicia is a fairly small community that within their comprehensive plan had designated this entire downtown neighborhood, both the historic Main Street and the adjacent residential neighborhoods as mixed use, no definition. And it really jeopardized the quality and the character of these residential areas, which somebody could come in and tear down the buildings and build a four-story commercial office building. And so what we did within this code is we worked within the framework of their historic conservation plan and basically adapted and modified transect to reinforce the mixed-use, vertical mixed-use pattern of the Main Street and then enable it to transition very quickly to a pattern that reinforces the residential use and physical form of the residential neighborhood. This is my last slide. I think what we're beginning to realize is that 3 years ago, you probably could have listed all of the form-based codes that are happening across the country on a couple of pages. We started gathering a list of those for our book, and after 7 or 8 pages and people continue to add to that list, we realize it's actually a really huge effort to try to do that, but there's extensive form-based coding happening out there, and we really feel that the next step in form-based coding, especially in California, with the power of the comprehensive plans, is actually thinking about the framework for the form-based coding as we're working on the comprehensive plan updates. And these are just some images from the city of Ventura, California, which is way ahead of the curve. Adopted a general plan a couple of years ago that actually utilized the transect as a framework for which they would organize their city and organize future form-based coding efforts. And because their primary goal was infill first to prevent growth and development on the agricultural lands, the first form-based code that they did was part of a specific plan for downtown Ventura, and Mullen Paul Zoides and Crawford Multry Clark worked on that. And since then, the city has had several other consultants working on form-based codes in other designated areas, and they've been using the same framework of the transect as this first code, in addition to the building types. And so it's a really, the jury is kind of yet to be out on this, but the city's really advanced in this application, really sort of at the frontier, and they're doing a really good job of sort of spearheading the thought process that needs to happen as far as form-based coding being coordinated with comprehensive plan updates. So just one last thing is, in talking to others who are have been doing a lot of form-based coding, since people are so busy, they tend to not know what anybody else is up to. And actually, I think we're really at a critical point with the advancement of form-based coding. It would be great to have a two-day council or summit, whatever you want to call it, and get the practitioners together to actually present their advancements and talk about where form-based coding is going and how to really continue to make it continue to enable to advance such a powerful regulatory tool. So I'm going to hand off the microphone to Sandy. So the other thing I wanted to say is we're going to actually collect questions over the course of the next two presentations. Carol Lang's going to be passing out note cards, so if you, as we're going through these presentations, just flag Carol down. We're going to collect questions and then answer those at the end of the session. Thank you.
Can we try to turn the light off so there was a darkness? Don't have to turn that on. for his hand.
Are we happy with her?
Yeah, okay. Can you guys see okay? Just hanging around? Okay. Hi, I'm Sandy Torley, and I've been working as an independent consultant with the Smart Code for Nordic firms and also cities and states of Mississippi and Louisiana, working since Hurricane Katrina a lot on the Gulf Coast with Smart Code version 8.0 that we customized for the state of Mississippi during the Mississippi Renewal Forum. This session being called Significant Work in Progress, I want to say that some of the significant work in progress with the Smart Code over this past year and a half has been using all this incredible amount of intent and frequent and sudden infill work and grayfield work and even greenfield where there's huge areas that are just wiped out on the Gulf to learn about how this fairly new code, Smart Code, is can be improved. So, and there are tremendous feedback loops over the past 18 months with this. Lots of activity on Smart Code listservs and on other listservs where I was just trying to gather as the principal editor of the information gatherer. So what we have, some of you took on the way in, is version 9.0, which is not officially out yet. We don't have the electronic file up yet. And these booklets are a convenience, but the entire base code is in here. It's there's a printing flaw in it, we're going to do it over, and you'll see there's some font issues, but the content is there. So that's significant work in progress, and since last week. And it's interesting the lessons we've learned working in areas that are severely damaged on the Gulf. And how much? Well, I'm from Philadelphia. I'm a Philadelphia native, and there are neighborhoods here that look like Mississippi Gulf Coast. We have a long hurricane, of course, in many of our cities. So this photograph is Francisville, North Philadelphia neighborhood, where we had the urban lab a couple of days ago. And in terms of form-based codes, we've been concentrating. Well, I'm not an architect like Dan and Stefano, so I would concentrate less on the building scale in this presentation and more on the community scale, the form of it. But the form-based code addresses the form of the region in the case of the Smart Code, and down to the community, and then to the bottom building. So we are encouraging the form on the right-hand side for the community. When working in existing urbanism, you're given some form already, and then how do you shape that and how do you plan for it? This is a pedestrian shed, a standard pedestrian shed on neighborhood Providence. We did an urban lab last year at CNU 14. And that's the 5-minute walk from edge to center, and that's a form around which you can organize the neighborhood. Or community. This is Francisco that we did a couple days ago, and these are three overlaid sheds that I don't think you can see part of the really large light yellow centered on the transit intersection near the orange circle. That's the long pedestrian shed for Broad and Girard, where the subway and trolley and bus. And then the oblong shed, the linear pedestrian shed that goes along Ridge Avenue, Whiskey Corridor, that's very, very distressed and in need of new fill. And we had centered the labs, all four of the urban labs, on that area. And then the very small shed, not a standard pedestrian shed, but it's an unofficial play shed for playgrounds for kids. It's an 18-mile of a year. So that was helpful to determine where they needed more playgrounds, that kind of thing, in the existing neighborhood. And then after community scale and pedestrian shed scale, one may be larger than the other, then you're at the transect zone scale. The transect is applied in our infill work at fine grain. So you would be working with the transect zones within pedestrian shed, at least with the urban ones. And this is a transect of from the air, October 2005, Mississippi Gulf Coast. So let me show this. And this is just from a 2-hour helicopter ride, and I thought afterwards, I wonder if there's a whole transect there. And there was. And this is Gulfport, the only city on the coast that most of us feel had an NT6. The only one would be Gulfport of the 11 cities. Gulfport was the first city on the coast to adopt the smart code of the whole city as a parallel option in February, and then Pasco Scan followed with the same a parallel option strategy. And now we're embarking on doing community plans after the adoption. And as they're done, the neighborhoods will decide whether they want to be a smart code planning area or whatever you want to call it. And then any work, any development that's done of any scale within that area would be, the smart code would be the exclusive code. That's the plan. Here's Francisville again, you know, struck by the similarities in the conditions. And this, I think, is a David Cole illustration I inherited. But the condition on the left, eerily like, you know, Mississippi from the air last year, eerily like Francis, part of Francisville, but actually, you know, the typical sprawl condition when cars aren't there everywhere, USA. So. And then what's the form of that retail and thoroughfares and so forth, the form is different on the right side, and in order to get that, it has to be coded until our culture of building returns, if ever. So all of these conditions, emergency, long emergency, the typical condition, are related. This is the view from the main street of Wayward, Mississippi, Coleman Avenue, was completely wiped out. And the difficulty there was how do you code for, how do you repair, how do you restore a place that is largely gone or completely gone? You listen to the people, what they had and what they want to see in the future. And then also we would collect the DNA of people who looked at photographs of nearby places. They said they liked the main street of Ocean Springs and Bay St. Louis. So we would photograph and take a measurement there. The teams would go out and then code the DNA from those places in order to make more in wavelength. This is Francisville again, and illustrated the frontage. This is one of the better frontages along Ridge Avenue. Right now, there were riots in the 60s that they never recovered from, and the retail really didn't come back, and there's a lot of barricades on the buildings that are even in business. Again, the difficulty of what do you replicate to make more of when there really isn't anything good there? You take it from somewhere else, you take it from the memories, the descriptions, you show photographs, all that, which can become a tricky business to, show later why it's tricky. And then transect helping to determine, you know, what's contextual in each zone. On the left, the auto, appropriate for the auto-dominated habitat, and on the right, appropriate for the pedestrian-dominated habitat, and it's not the use, it's the form. I'm going to put this in just about the most, how not to violate the transect, because it's a lot of interest. I'll show you a couple more transects real quick, just to show, because the smart code is a template, it's a model code, it's meant to be calibrated, it's meant to be customized for the place that's using it, which requires a charrette, requires a lot of public process to get the code that people want. And the idea is, if the public process is happening before the adoption of the code, then every project after that doesn't need to be scrutinized through the public process the way it is now. Because that business is already incorporated into the code. So I'm going to show two different trend sets, a Philadelphia trend set down in New Orleans. So this is where I was taken for to publish as far as most of you have gotten to the 7 mile long this morning. Or 6 days if you're already at that. This is all within the city limits. It's not the only T3 that we have, but it's a typical T3 that would fit into the parameters of the wide parameters of the smart code template. But when we get to T4, I'm often accused of trying to edit and revise the smart code. I'm not the principal author, of course, of EQZ, but I'm accused of trying to influence it in the direction of Philadelphia. That's what I know and love, and it's a row house fabric, as we've seen. So T4 is, most of the T4 in Philadelphia is attached housing, rear yard disposition. So here are some different examples of row houses throughout Philadelphia. In slightly different frontages, the stoop and the portion of the fence wall there. And this is another T4 shot showing that in the smart code template, referring to what Dan was talking about with 9021, the restricted, limited, and open categories. But those are function categories. And it enables you, I love using that also as a way to get in between zones in a way. The smart code is a form-based code, it's a transect-based code, but it's also a use-based code, but importantly, it's a mixed-use-based code. So the zones are not separated uses, they're not single use. They're degrees of misuse in going up in intensity as the numbers go up. And in this T4, in the template, before it's customized, it shows T4 as having a limited function, which is you can have a corner store, I think every corner in the T4 is overall. So that's the typical condition in Philadelphia. Like this, and the mix of housing types, you get roads. This is out in Roxboro, which is further about 8 miles from here, and you have all the housing types in our T4 there. And then T507, Main Street, and I like this picture because it shows that actually there's a danger in coding height by stories alone. Those are both three-story buildings. So we have a little, in 9.0, well, the manual notes for it, we've advised a strategy for coding so that it's a little more predictable than that for places that are very concerned about the height limit, maybe for their tree tops or their view shed recorders. And then T6, you know very well now. The buildings, which are not part of the transects, they have standards outside of the code for architects to go next. Okay, the New Orleans transect is from T3, two different sort of income levels of T3. Little cottages and grand houses. And their T4 is looser than what you don't find in row houses in the residential neighborhoods. The upper right image could be a T4 Main Street. The character T5 in this market template is a Main Street or a town center or a town square with full mixed use at the town village scale and the neighborhood scale. But you see, there are many Main Streets that have cottages, single family houses, galleries, and so forth. Very kind of loose, but nevertheless, full mixed use. And when we talk to people away from Mississippi about exchange ideas about the transect and what would you guys like in your Main Street since you're starting from scratch here. And they decided they wanted a T4 Main Street in form in terms of building type and then open function. So that was a way to modulate. And it's not the only way to do it, but it's a very useful tool to have that. And then the T5 in New Orleans does have a patch housing in there from the core. And taking too long to confess. So the throughout the smart code, you'll see that the various standards are correlated to to the transect zones to create an immersive environment and distinct habitats for different kinds of living arrangements. And so the black squares on the right graph indicate. And again, this is a template meant to be customized, and there may be different frontage types, and there may be, this is a typical situation in infill, the tear downs of the traditional fabric, and the smart code or other form-based codes can be tremendously protected against this kind of thing. Okay, you know, the entire setback effect is a setback. And another tool that's useful is rather than subzoning by numbers like 4.5, 5.5, or using the three functions we talked about, marking on regulating plan, something like mandatory shop front frontage, where you would get something like this. Even if the density wasn't as high as maybe 1 or 2.5, you could, or 2.6, you could modulate that way. And it's from England. And then last couple slides here, the difficulty of showing photographs in places where they don't actually have what they might want in the future is they like them and they might not be appropriate. And so in educating in general about frontages, we talk about, well, the gallery frontage is great, probably people from the sun and rain. And here's a AP grocery store in the French Quarter. And the Francisville residents during Lyle a couple days ago really liked these pictures of the Southern Gallery, so they decided that they wanted mandatory gallery frontage all the way down Ridge Avenue. But then we were reminded that it snows here and it's dark in the winter and so forth. So there's a reason that locally customized, we might not do that here. And there's a sequence of global calibration in terms of getting the smart code to reflect your place rather than the other way around, the good part of your place. And this is just the form of this mapping survey that we used to go out and measure metrics to extract the DNA from good parts of the city or from other places, and then determine what the parameters are to input them into these tables, and this is the summary table in the smart code that contains all the metrics in the reference code on one page and all two guns. And that's it. And I'm sorry I took too long. Thank you.
Practice, and And our two presentations are almost exactly parallel to each other, but I'm going to give you an impression of how the code looks as a final product after the research is done, as Sandy related to you. I begin with this. I'm dealing with this image because I want to remind you that I had trouble explaining to my French rationalist friends and to my American libertarian friends that this actually is the highest and most precise definition of a system of planning that is almost military in its intensity and clarity, and it is meant to be. So one of the strongest kinds of responses that people not sympathetic with neuroscience have is that coding is actually an imposition of the body. In fact, it's actually in many ways a clarification, in many more ways maybe a deregulation of utterly disastrous, irrational, and politically difficult system that is in place. Trying to take it forward, but it's not coming forward. And it's not that it gives me a moment, so. A few principles first. Our building form is important as land use regulation and predictable toward physical outcomes, based on local precedent. And there's a very strong relationship between building and open space, void and solid. Mixed use and mixed housing throughout. Greater attention to detail, particularly in the public realm. Standards constantly directed to outcomes. And a public process that is design biased. And the principal components of placemaking are architectural, streets, blocks and blocks, public realms and streetscape, and buildings. And the general overview of what is attempted in the two separate and different systems of regulation is that you get variegated blocks, context-responsive circulation, open space is integral and varied in the neighborhoods, pedestrian-friendly frontages, compatibility of dimensions and directions in irrigation of buildings, a range of density, variety of types, and sustainable management of resources, while in the opposite system you're getting virtually the diametrical opposite. And in the end, this is not surprising to you, I think, there are a number of instruments that are used in our work, the regulatory plan, land use regulations, block and street standards, urban standards, and architectural standards. And those are discrete, separate, and produced in the context of a vision and of an intended outcome. And they're so organized so they can be found and easily made part of a project. Very easily. I apologize, I'm in many years training, this is not, I think, a great projection or anything. I begin with this project just simply to remind you that all that Sandy spoke about, all that you know about the mainstream practice of interpretivism, is entirely accommodated in this slide. It's called a physical-based vision. In effect, what we're saying here is there can be no form-based coding without a project of understanding the future of a place based on the on public interaction and on the deliberation of the principles of the charter of urbanism, so that the physical form of neighborhood, district, corridor, block, and building, of course, in a regional context, character and scale of the above, and connectivity to the surrounding community are actually essential for every project to proceed. There has to be an architectural extension of the ideas of what the place ought to be forward, because the protocols like this can be coded. And the regulatory framework for a project is actually the regulatory plan, which you see here divided into a number of transit drive intensities. And the critical idea is that every color represents a development intensity, and every border represents an aspect of circulation framework and of open space. There is integral to form-based codes conditions for regulating uses per zone. So the rumor that form-based codes are not use-based codes is actually not true. Form-based codes are use-based codes, and in ways that are similar to conventional zoning discipline, actually control the distribution of potential uses per zone. Very interesting within the subject of coding our practice is the question of subdivision. We always introduce, for reasons of arriving at small grain traditional urbanism, subdivision standards that follow this five steps: creating new blocks, introducing streets, by introducing streets, introducing alleys, introducing lots, and introducing projects. And this five steps, with appropriate dimensional safeguards, one can clearly arrive at the traditional proportions of a great urban grid. Inherent to the design of the form-based code is the control of street and street types. The street character and the nature of the entire network, calibrated for particular conditions of development along this course, is absolutely an integral part of the code, as are the technical details of every street in the portions of the plan that they apply. Similarly, with open space standards, it is possible in a quality code to delineate open space types and to distribute them per zone and qualify them in a very rich way that allows people to place them in design as necessary over time. The standards here are size, access, parking, landscape, hardscape, frontage of buildings on an open space, a building within it as improvements and so on and uses. There is also, in our codes, an extensive streetscape standard section that introduces trees by type. Our codes along the entire ecological introduces tree species and projects the character of streets based on the form of trees. And after here, there's nothing surprising about any of those things. I'm just reiterating those things to get to one point that I want to make there. These are urban standards which cover intended character and land uses, building placement and encroachments, parking requirements and placement, building types, frontage types, and architectural site guidelines per zone. So the point I want to come to today, but the reason why I want to have this discussion, is to give you this general context and to talk about architectural types, building types in particular. Particularly relative to the discussion this morning on architecture, I think one of the most significant problems with the way in which American cities and world cities are made is that most conventional zoning budgets actually introduce entitlement to the subject by allowing the introduction in the body of the grid of volume, buildable volume, based on some kind of abstract numerical device, whether it's FAR or envelope-based entitlement, etc. So whatever it is, it is actually some kind of abstraction to which a theoretical developer is actually entitled to on a particular piece of land. The result of that is that modernist architecture for the last 75 years has really actually come to the conclusion that what architecture is the taking of that volume, that block in the abstract, and the chiseling it and skinning it and working on it, and then introducing it into a city as an appropriate contribution to the fabric of the place. The result, of course, as you know, just by looking around the three blocks around the place where we are today, is absolutely catastrophic, because cities are not made by entitlement abstractions of this kind. They're made by the imposition of building types into the body of lots in the context of streets and blocks. This is the way in which American urbanism and stuff has happened since the landing of the English and Spanish and the French on this continent, and the early attempts to make settlements. This is the way in which orderly cities are made. All the rest is a form of cancer that has actually so distorted the forms of cities that they become some kind of sweepstake for out of control development rights, as opposed to a place of a semblance of compatibility in the making of one. So we know that for 50 years we've built single family houses, stacked flats, and towers. This has been the conventional practice based on FAR entitlements. We have not built duplexes to quads, row houses, quarter housing, or commercial blocks for generations. And the ones we've built can be counted to be probably less than half of 1%. And yet, these are the types that give us the heart of the best towns and cities we have in this country. Those are the types that operate in the zones of the highest quality urbanity we've known. And those are the ones that we have to continue to build in order to get the kind of there we want there. It is not a matter of style that keeps us from doing this. It is a matter of actually cancelling the entitlement process from abstraction to the actual specificity of building their quality. And in our codes, we've come to the conclusion it's very, very important to describe these in the constituent elements of each type, in part because to direct developers and builders and others, and in part to engender a kind of civic dialogue and a level of education among people, so they can really basically understand what this subject is all about. I want to also remind you that there is a particular virus in the architectural world that suggests that every building needs to be a work of art, and it's a work of art in the terms that particularly have to do with the uniqueness of its conception. And we all know from 2,500 years of urban history that 95% of the building of cities in the world has to do with repetition of models. It is really typology that is the grand bridge between architecture and urbanism. And architecture is a way of giving character of presence to types when it comes to the repeating part of the architectural profession, and give particularly extravagant and special form to institutional and one of buildings, which are really to be dominant over all others. But what has happened in this last two generations of sprawl culture is that every building, from a bathroom addition to the Empire State Building, needs to be a unique building. And the concept of the repetition is entirely rejected. And it's our hope that by introducing typology, not as a break on architectural creativity, but as a vehicle for actually building up the fabric of the city and entitling development, that will in fact begin to see compatibly related fabric in cities. And in most of our work, we present these kinds of ranges of typology, organized per zone, as you can see in this simple diagram, with some prescriptions of block width and of density range versus their applicability. But they vary from place to place, and they have to do with both the precedence and the history of the places you're working in, and the degree to which you want to see a place be regenerated in a certain density fabric. One very simple example to give you is in the case of Pasadena, for instance, my hometown, where a lot of the work built in the last 10 years, absolutely despised by many of the neighbors in the neighborhood surrounding the downtown, are of this nature. Because FAR entitlement has allowed somebody to build a building that's 590 feet long and 4 stories high. And in fact, what we're trying to do instead is, in density, it's not terribly dissimilar from one that we saw. We're trying to build buildings up to maybe 50 of these barriers, particularly ones in 35, that in fact generate a dwelling place based on house form. And by allowing through coding different kinds of intensities of volume in per story, we can then make a building that can be both, site specific, 1 story, 2 stories, 3 stories, 4 stories, and also responsive to the needs of the developing community. There are frontage standards that exist in our codes beyond that. This is a building of particularly poor frontage. We describe those frontages the way many of you do. We assign those frontages to particular zones. And we are particularly interested and agile in observing types with different frontages. The case of corded housing with 3 different frontages. We are in the business of trying to figure out what it is that we want to accomplish by gaining inspiration from what's in place. And on the style side, our work typically deals with 3 levels of potential regulation based on the context. One is the identification of architectural styles per zone, the character defining features of these in terms of scale and proportion, and then the appropriateness of those to typology. And not to repeat the last slide of Sandy, but to reiterate it in many ways. The existing conditions analysis is the first effort. Public vision charrette is a formative condition. Regulated plan in zones are the basic framework of zoning application. Developing urban standards for a variety of dimensions of the project. Architectural standards are optional depending on the circumstances. The allocation and the illustration of standards is absolutely essential. The testing of the code is vital, and the splicing of the standards into existing regulatory systems that are negative and not supportive of this work is also a particular necessity. It is very important for you to know that in our work, we often work with 3 different levels of regulation. You can see character intensity, subdivision of land, urban standards, architectural standards, administration. And there are 3 levels of regulation that have to do with heavier or lighter versions of applications as the case allows. And the last slide is actually a form-based code framework at the end of the charrette, where on the left-hand side, this the projection so that I can read my own slide here. But every single standard being calibrated from the character of the place to the architectural types, to the urban standards, to the frontages, every single standard is presented per zone, is gathered per zone, is discussed and calibrated and validated per zone, is presented at the end of the charrette as a basic core material for actual construction to go. So this is as far as we've taken our work, and I just want to reiterate that we believe very strongly that the introduction of our special standards is actually the only guarantee that we have that when we get the kind of towns and cities that we aspire to in urban extension.
Okay, so we have a list of questions that we're going to work our way through here. Not sure we're going to get through all these, but we'll try to get through as many as possible. I'm just going to ask these to the panel here. The first question is, can you address the implementation process for form-based codes?
The strategies for adoption have to take into account, you know, looking ahead, as they were talking about in the big city zoning session this morning, looking ahead to can city staff handle this? So our biggest question is, should the strategy be to devise a parallel code, parallel to the existing dimensional code so that it can be chosen? But then the city staff has to administer two codes while they're learning this new one, right? Or do you go through the lengthy, much more lengthy process usually of, for instance, in Miami 21, of rewriting the zoning code and replacing it completely and it's the exclusive code? Still, there's going to be a learning curve, but then during the administration, there would only be the one to deal with. So these are what you have to weigh, and it might be dependent on the size and the sophistication of the city and the staff.
There's a bias in favor of outcomes that are physical, and I think the planning profession needs to lead in the direction of learning how to administer a framework that is architectural, in the same way that many of us have to learn how to deal with frameworks that are planning frameworks. I mean, there is a disease in the land that has to do with the fact that we are operating in completely isolated territories, not knowing what each other are doing. There's a lot of support. And I don't think it's easy to work with an existing group of people changing from one kind of zoning to the other. It's not impossible to do. So it has to do with goodwill, education, and the will to be effective. And what's the question?
There's also the question of will the code be watered down if it's presented as if it's going to be your only code? And will it be watered down during the adoption, during the public process? You may get a pure form-based code adopted if you present it as an option and you less objection to it. That theoretically. But it's playing out, you know, in different ways, in different places.
Okay, the second question I'm actually going to direct to Sam Poole, who's a member of a form-based code institute. He's an attorney that it's actually a question that's basically what have been the legal challenges faced by municipalities adopting form-based codes. That's the question you're seeing.
Frankly, I'm not aware of any legal challenges directed at whether or not something is a form-based code. I am aware of challenges in Miami of the form-based code, but the issue had to do with the way that particular landowner was treated under the code. And the challenge was simply if you enforce that against us, we will file an indication so they will simply carve out that particular area. We may see in Miami 21 that Sandy has mentioned, I was at a public hearing 2 weeks ago, and virtually every land use attorney in the city was there complaining that the code had so many problems, it was unworkable. The general issue that they're complaining about is the rights that they get under the code. They're not complaining about the fact that it is a form-based code versus the conventional somehow that's the organic way to govern land use. And in fact, the form-based code approach predates that all the way back into colonial times and prior to colonial times. So it's just that there's a, my brethren in the legal profession don't like to think a lot, and you may find some resistance in city or county attorneys to the adoption. They may not like having drawings in their codes, but there is really nothing that is precedent setting or inappropriate or legal or unconstitutional. One plug, we're having form-based code 101 in the next courses in Fort Worth, June 14th, 14th to 15th, 14th to 16th. So this is, these are some of the issues that we cover in form-based code.
The next question has to do with the question of describe the process for a shred in preparation for a form-based code/smart code application. I think we can have a quick answer from both.
The smart code shred that we did on the golf are typically 5 days, 5-6 days, and they're similar to other newer bit shred, possibly shorter. But you still are doing a plan in order to calibrate the code. I mean, not only are you going out and doing metric analysis of existing conditions or of ideal conditions that you want to code for, related conditions that you want to code for, but you're also doing a plan in order to determine where the transect zones are going to go in transect-based code. And where your frontages might be mandated and so forth. In the case of Gulfport and Pass Christiane, they were rough plans and were not adopted with the code. The codes were adopted, without a map. So now the community mapping is being done from within each neighborhood, each community plan is very simplified. So there's then that's another level of a smaller scale charrette, and allows the neighborhood to kind of own their own. But the T-zones for the whole city were already, they're adopted in the code, what T-zones are, and they have to be citywide. You can't have different T5 in different neighborhoods with the same jurisdiction.
I'm just going to answer a quick question myself. It was, what's the largest city that has adopted form-based code? And I think the largest city that has a form-based code for the entire city is probably Montgomery, unless anybody knows anything differently. Could they adopt it in an optional code, smart code for the entire city, and have gone back and done one for the downtown? Incredibly, that's the largest city. The city of Miami, the Miami 21 code is actually in the final stages. It's actually going to the city council. It's supposed to be at the end of this month, but currently got pushed out a month because of just sort of the fine grain calibration that's necessary. So that will very quickly, soon, be adopted.
Are there any codes that address development of varying topography beyond that that should be preserved, like 20% slopes? I think it's the kind of issue that does not need to be resolved through the code, that's the issue gets resolved through a shred proceeding approach.
Here's one for smart code specifically. Question: how does smart code deal with less than ideal lot configurations that lie within the transect, within the transect zone, i.e., undersized or oddly shaped lots? Well, the main regulation is lot width, because that affects frontage and affordability. The shape, you can have an oddly shaped lot that would still fall within parameters of the transect zone. They're parametric. You know, it's not like, okay, well, here it's, you know, T5 is 16 feet wide lot. There's a range. If it's something that is non-conforming, there's still the variance procedure. And in fact, the smart code has a two-level procedure for non-conforming conditions, and one is the warrant, which is administrative, and the other is the variance, which is the public process to wait in there.
Just I'll answer this next one since we're running short on time. I just wanted to give quick answers to these and we'll hang around shortly afterward. But is every form-based code a transect-based code? And the quick answer to that is no. We have found that a large majority of them are, but there are codes that are non-transect based. And the other question is every form-based code a unified development code that combines zoning and subdivision regulations? And I would say that it really varies on a case-by-case basis. For instance, in the city of Grass Valley, that was a development code update, so it not only included the zoning code update, but also the subdivision ordinance. And so that it did include those two pieces, but it's really determined in this early scoping process of form-based code of whether or not actual subdivision ordinances will be included. So it's part of the early decision in the process because it's basically an extra step in the form-based code.
The next one is, what do you think of the main advantage of form-based codes over patent books like celebration? Celebrations. And the answer is that the two notions are not antithetical. Actually, all of the patent book is, like celebrations, is the most stringent form of architectural regulation. So if the simplest form of architectural regulation is a mere outline of the architectural styles, of the elements of architectural styles, element prevalent in the area, the next level might be a more binding standard description of proportions and scales. Clearly, a patent book begins to determine in minute detail the particulars of expression across the entire spectrum of styles. But preceding that, there is the entire panoply of standards and regulations we spoke about. So a patent book is a piece of the action at the extreme regulatory edge of architectural codes.
One of the views of the transect is that the patent book can be correlated to the transect, so that when you get to this very minute scale, it can still be coordinated with what has been coded before. And I guess we are about to go to a plenary session, but if anyone has a specific question, they can grab us in a few minutes after.
Yes, thank you for coming. I just wanted to note that one of the questions referred to resources and courses on form-based coding. The Form-Based Code Institute holds 101, 201, and 301 level courses in the handout that Carol handed out, as well as the Smart Code workshops held throughout the country. Both have websites and they're on the handout, so I just refer you to those websites.
There is also a question here about the relationship between form-based codes, market demand, and cost. And if the person who asked this question wants to come here and talk to us about it, we'll stick around.